Global Times added, the total debt of $31 trillion also indicates that there will be more intense political combat on issues related to congressional appropriations in Washington, which means almost all major federal projects and initiatives will be difficult to deliver, affecting the country's internal economic vitality and its external influence. In addition, experts added, the last time the U.S. debt was this close to its ceiling, the government was nearly forced to shut down. And the increasingly high debt will also harm the basic operation of the federal government. And an increasing debt burden will naturally raise concerns about the ability of the U.S. government to service the debt and even the possibility of extremes in future U.S. internal and external policies, such as provoking volatility, unrest, or even a war-oriented foreign policy to shift or even find ways to renege on its debt, which has indeed happened in U.S. history. This sentiment alone could potentially undermine the full faith and credit of the U.S. The Congressional Budget Office earlier this year released a report on America's debt load, warning in its 30-year outlook that if unaddressed, the debt will soon spiral upward to new highs that could ultimately imperil the U.S. economy, according to an AP report. According to Global Times, the current level of inflation in the U.S. should not be underestimated. Coupled with high oil prices, the energy disputes between the U.S., Europe, and Russia, as well as the Russia-Ukraine crisis and other complex international situations, the challenge of a $31 trillion national debt should be considered in the context of the risky crises currently facing Washington. If the persistent upward trend cannot be resolved, the attractiveness of the U.S. as a global pool of capital and talent will be further eroded, hitting its strength in all aspects. However, it's important to note the reality that the U.S. is accustomed to adopting various policies to deflect conflicts, leaving ordinary Americans and other countries to bear the ultimate cost. The U.S. is not playing the role of a stabilizer in the global economy that a major power should do. Instead, it has repeatedly held others accountable for the consequences when it makes mistakes. As the birthplace of several post-World War's global economic crises, the U.S. could once again become a chaos maker at the expense of economic development around the world, given that the debt, as well as its economic and monetary policies, will all raise the possibility of another global financial crisis in the future. Also, New York Times wrote, America's gross national debt exceeded $31 trillion for the first time, a grim financial milestone that arrived just as the nation's long-term fiscal picture has darkened amid rising interest rates. The breach of the threshold, which was revealed in a Treasury Department report, comes at an inopportune moment, as historically low interest rates are being replaced with higher borrowing costs as the Federal Reserve tries to combat rapid inflation. While record levels of government borrowing to fight the pandemic and finance tax cuts were once seen by some policymakers as affordable, those higher rates are making America's debts more costly over time. New York Times added, the $31 trillion threshold also poses a political problem for Biden, who has pledged to put the United States on a more sustainable fiscal path and reduce federal budget deficits by $1 trillion over a decade. Deficits occur when the government spends more money than it takes in the thorough tax revenue. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget estimates that Biden's policies have added nearly $5 trillion to deficits since he took office. That projection includes Biden's signature $1.9 trillion economic stimulus bill, a variety of new congressionally approved spending initiatives, and a student loan debt forgiveness plan that is expected to cost taxpayers nearly $400 billion over 30 years. White House budget officials estimated in August that the deficit would be just over $1 trillion for the 2022 fiscal year, which was nearly $400 billion less than they had originally forecast. Biden says those numbers are the product of his policies to stoke economic growth, like the American Rescue Plan. Those figures obscure the effects of the rescue plan, which was financed entirely with borrowed money. Much of the deficit reduction Biden is doing reflects the fact that both he and former President Trump signed laws that borrowed heavily in order to mitigate the damage of the pandemic recession. The deficit has fallen in large part because policymakers did not pass another large round of pandemic aid this year.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the political ideology promoted by right-wing Hindu nationalists in India has infiltrated foreign lands, including the US and the UK. Also, deep ties between these groups that thrive on hate crimes and religious polarization and the Islamophobic forces in the West.
The controversial political ideology prompted by an array of vigilante, political and cultural groups in India through violence is slowly but alarmingly infiltrating foreign lands, including the United States. Hindutva, a combination of Hindu fascism and supremacy, thrives on religious polarization, fanning tensions between Hindus and Muslims and institutionalizing Islamophobia. The recent events in the United States, the astounding rise of Hindu nationalist forces, have fueled concerns that political and religious polarization in India is slowly seeping into diaspora communities.
During the Independence Day parade on August 14 in the northeastern U.S. state of New Jersey, Hindutva groups rolled a bulldozer carrying photos of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Uttar Pradesh Chief Minister Adityanath, the two distinguished poster boys of Hindu nationalism. It was quite symbolic. Over the last several months, the right-wing governments in the Indian states of Uttar Pradesh, Gujarat, and Madhya Pradesh have carried out demolition drives using bulldozers, targeting properties owned by Muslims in the name of removing encroachments. Rights groups in the U.S. said they were deeply disturbed by the symbolism, as bulldozers have become a symbol of state repression and violence against India's minorities.
strain of Islamophobia that was prominent in the 20th century, most prominent in the later half of the 20th century. But what accelerates this entire process is the war on terror and the September 11 attacks, and this kind of creates a fertile ground on which later leaders could use the rhetoric and gain a lot of popularity.
More recently, in another disturbing development, a member of a notorious Hindutva group was appointed to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Faith-Based Religious Council. The group he represents is the overseas arm of the RSS, an ultra-right-wing extremist organization. The Hindutva groups active in the U.S. have reportedly recruited and funded many prominent American lawmakers, including former Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, Congressman Raja Krishnamurti, Michigan State Representative Padma Kupa, and former Texas State Representative Siri Kulkarni, attesting to the fact that Hindutva fascism has not only arrived but entrenched deeply in America's socio-political fabric.
Islamophobic rhetoric normalized by BJP leaders in India has gradually infiltrated pockets of Indian American diaspora through radical Hindu groups such as the Hindu American Political Action Committee, the Overseas Friends of the BJP, the Indian Business Association, and Hindu Swayamsevak Sangh. It has sparked fear and concern in the American Muslim community, especially with these fascist groups supported by the U.S. intelligence apparatus, as well as the powerful Hindutva lobby groups that wield considerable influence in Washington.
Although the infiltration of radical Hindutva groups into American communities has increased at an astounding pace in recent years, it has a history in places such as New Jersey with a sizable immigrant population. A recent report by the South Asia Citizen Web disclosed financial information and expenditures of at least 24 Hindutva groups and found that seven such groups spend nearly $160 million under programming, which includes sending funds to radical Hindu groups in India. Last year, the New Jersey legislators even felicitated the World Hindu Council, which has direct links with Vishwa Hindu Parishad, the ultra-right-wing Hindu organization based in India.
Hindutva is like, it's a political ideology that is rooted to 19th century Bengal, we can say, but it establishes the Hindus as the original inheritors of the land, and also at the same time it otherizes non-Hindus and creates the non-Hindus as foreign encroachers in the land, and with context to India is basically Muslims.
All these groups with branches across dozens of countries fall under the umbrella of Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is the parent organization of India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. RSS's growing footprint in the U.S. has become a cause of concern for American Muslims. For instance, the appointment of a leading Hindutva figure to DHS's Faith-Based Religious Council recently drew sharp reactions. Rashid Ahmed, executive director of the Indian American Muslim Council, wondered how could a member of a group whose parent organization in India is implicated in violence against religious minorities be a good fit for the position? No one had the answer.
Hindu nationalism has in recent years seen an alarming surge under the Bharatiya Janata Party in India, which rose to power in 2014. It coincided with Donald Trump's tenure as the US president, who redefined fascist politics and institutionalized Islamophobia in the United States. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Trump complemented each other well. Both are affiliated with right-wing political parties, and more importantly, both are rabidly anti-Muslim. So it's hardly any surprise that Hindutva groups mushroomed in the U.S. under Trump's watch.
In September 2019, around 50,000 people gathered in the U.S. city of Houston at a rare mass rally for Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. It came a month after India stripped the disputed region of Jammu and Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status, sparking tensions. It also came amid a brutal crackdown on immigrants in India's northeastern state of Assam, which left nearly 2 million Muslims from Bangladesh at risk of statelessness. Trump lavished praise on Modi, calling him a great man and a great leader. In February 2020, Modi returned the favor when Trump visited India. The effusive bond between the two leaders was on full display, which many described as a fascist alliance. While grievous crimes against Muslims in India assumed alarming proportions under Narendra Modi, marked by hate crimes, mob vigilantism, demolition of mosques, and sedition laws under Donald Trump, Islamophobia in the U.S. peaked dramatically. He campaigned against Muslims, imposed a travel ban for citizens from Muslim countries, and mainstreamed racist attacks against minorities. A timeline of the megalomaniac former U.S. president's comments about Islam and Muslims is quite revealing, which also explains why and how these radical Hindutva groups gained a foothold in the U.S. under him and later went berserk under his successor, Joe Biden.
The United States isn't the only country to be engulfed by the Hindutva wave. Britain has also seen RSS-inspired mob violence in recent years, particularly in Leicester, which is home to over 100,000 Muslims and Hindus. Most recently, far-right Hindutva groups were accused of targeting Muslim residents in the city in September in a bid to sow seeds of discord in a mixed community. The events in Leicester and other British cities pointed a full-blown rise of Hindutva fascism in the country.
On September 18th, a large mob of right-wing Hindus took to the streets in Leicester, chanting Hindutva slogans. They headed toward a mosque and intimidated local Muslims, which prompted retaliation. Reports in the British media attributed to communal tensions, blaming both sides. But independent observers and eyewitnesses assert that it was Hindutva groups that indulged in violence and vandalism. The Muslim Council of Britain said the violence followed a series of provocations from far-right Hindutva groups over a number of months. Leicester has a 13% Muslim population and a 12.3% Hindu population, and most of the people are ethnically Indian.
As a Muslim myself, I can tell you that there is this kind of fear of speaking about my choices or the kind, and also this need to justify them of why I'm doing certain things. However, the recent, whatever's been happening recently, the protest around the world, it kind of gives us a hope that maybe there will be a change. But at the same time, there's a great fear that, you know, either we'll be misunderstood or we'll be misjudged or something of that sort.
Experts attributed the Leicester violence to violent Hindu extremism across the broader Indian diaspora, driven by the political ideology of Hindutva championed by India's ruling party. Ironically, following the violence in Leicester, India's High Commission in London condemned what it called the vandalization of premises and symbols of Hindu religion, but made no reference to Hindu violence targeting Muslims. According to activists, proponents of Hindutva have had a presence in the UK for decades, but recent events signal an escalation that has given rise to fear and concern within the Muslim community. What makes it even worse is the alliance between the Tories and the BJP.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insights, we are joined by Mr. Sayyid Muaz Shah, the director at Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Shah. Now, how did the political ideology prompted by the right-wing Hindu nationalists in India reach the US and the UK?
Well, that's a very good question. And actually, this journey has started many years ago. There's been an active effort by Indian authorities and the Indian government to connect with their diaspora and to make them as a powerful tool for political purposes. If I can give you an example, everyone remembers about 2-3 years ago when the Kashmir Article 370 issue arose. There were serious concerns of human rights violations that occurred in Kashmir, so much to the extent that even a U.S. congressman attempted to fly into Kashmir to look at that. But before even that, the U.S. Congress took notice of this and wanted to hold a hearing. And the chairman of that committee actually received 96,000 letters, emails from various Indian Americans who basically kind of wrote in so much summary of words that they shouldn't have this committee hearing to look over this issue, and that Pakistan is the troublesome and Islamic extremism is the real issue in Kashmir, and so forth and so forth. So the level of impact, the mobilization is demonstrative in this one event. I mean, to have in 24 hours, you know, to be able to mobilize 96,000 Indian Americans to flood a congressman's, the committee chairman's office, this is quite coordinated. And I think one of the things that the Indians have been doing, which I think is very interesting, is they've been studying the Israelis. So as we know, the Israeli lobby is very strong in the United States and the United Kingdom for quite some time. The Indians have been taking a leaf from their playbook. And that's basically what's being played. So when we see these type of scenarios, often at times we don't see a condemnation. We see kind of a, you know, politicians in other countries looking over this for the interest. Of course, there's deep business interests as well. But there is an effective campaign to keep the narrative that's going on in India and then the Modi regime connected with its diaspora, to use them as a tool.
Sir, Hindutva groups have developed a strong foothold in the U.S. and European countries in recent years. So the question is, has the growing tide of Islamophobia in the West made this possible?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Hindutva feeds into Islamophobia. Islamophobia feeds into Hindutva. There's a very strong correlation of it. There's a lot of studies that have already gone on, and they kind of feed into each other. Obviously, one's promoting the idea of hatred or a fear against some faith, and the other is, moreover, Hindutva, which is promoting its own self as, you know, being the Hinduness and how Hindu are you, which then is connected to the nationalistic feelings. Now, what's really interesting, of course, is that these cultural values, these religious values, it's not like they were invented in the sense that root core of them have always existed, but they're being mobilized now at this point to bring a new era of nationalism and right-wingism that we can see throughout the world, an idea in which people are reflecting of who they are and what's their self-identity. So we're moving away from where the world at one time was moving towards, you know, cohesion, one world government, the United Nations, to a more bifurcated sectionalisms in society because of some of the challenges, the economic challenges, the COVID challenges. Anytime we see human society brought with these massive challenges, there's a reaction to it to try to then, of course, save yourselves in so many words. And often the blame is then shifted to others who are minorities or other than you. So it's a re-strengthening of your own identity vis-a-vis also then, you know, supplanting a negativeness on that. So Hindutva, obviously raising their own identity amongst Hindus, and then, of course, suppressing the other. These go hand in hand. And it's quite in such a correlation that we see an explosion of this type of behavior connected. So so much so that Islamophobia is intertwined now with Hindutvas or the Hinduness because the fear of Islam, the references that Hindutva, you know, politicians and, of course, people give about Islam will do this and the fear of Islam. And if you, you know, do this, your women will be this. And there's a lot of issues that, again, you could do many researches in different areas to be able to come to this. But there's a correlation definitely between these two.
Sir, we've seen that anti-Muslim violence has surged since the BJP government rose to power in India in 2014. Now, do you think Modi's alliance with Trump in the US and the Tories in the UK helped Hindutva groups infiltrate those countries?
Absolutely. As I said earlier in my previous response, that you know, you have to look at where the world dynamics are shifting. Far right parties are coming to power, nationalists, because there's a sense of uncertainty in global economics and global health and so forth with this COVID crisis. So what's happening is that these parties generally politically lean into each other. That's a major issue. Another major issue, I would say, is, of course, this rivalry with China, which really plays more so with the United States, more so than the United Kingdom. But here, the United States looks at India as a piece that is an anchor for them to contain China, as they do with Japan as well in the similar capacity. And so this is something that for America is extremely important. So that's why they look over some of their crimes and some of their situations that are happening to a certain extent. Vis-a-vis when you look at some other countries, if you put them in the same situation, they face certain, revealing concerning responses that the United States gives to them through sanctions or through, you know, a reprimand or so forth. So the standard is not the same because there's a political advantage that they want to keep with Modi's government. And Modi understands that. And this also has to do with business. Business is also really big. You know, we have, of course, India being one of the major increasing trade players in the world, particularly due to population and consumption, particularly with the explosion of the IT market and outsourcing that started many years ago. And that, of course, has expanded. And business interests have entered the United Kingdom and the United States. You know, you look at Tata Group that ended up buying Land Rover and Jaguar. So these things indicate that there's strong, deep-rooted influences that, of course, have an impact. And we're seeing that impact right now put in the political sphere when we see with this recent selection of the British prime ministership. With a man who basically is very strongly identifies himself as a Hindu. And then, of course, he has had some very strong comments against Islamic extremism. I mean, he basically said that, you know, which has become, quote, a significant terror threat in the United Kingdom. Now, how significant? And was asked that, what do you mean by this? He says, people with extreme hatred to Britain. What's that going to translate to? That's going to basically translate to Islamophobia being activated, and then people being racially profiled, people being subjected to human rights abuses, and these things will happen. In fact, the current Prime Minister, Rishi, was selected, and he was asked about that, also Liz Truss, about what they're going to do about Islamophobia, and he was silent. He didn't have a response. So this, again, going back to your earlier question about how these two go together, it's a natural cohesion. Because it's about pride of putting your culture, your Hinduness above others, and somehow a sense of superiority, which sounds very similar to something that we've seen in Germany a few decades ago.
And finally, sir, let's talk about the recent incidents in UK, as there were brutal attacks on Muslims and their properties in Leicester, attributed to the far-right Hindutva groups. So does this point to the rise of Hindu fascism in the country?
Absolutely. And I think at this point, it's at a pinnacle. That event that happened in Leicester is something that really shows that the impact this is having of this relationship, what it's coming down to. And, you know, there's some things that's very interesting. And I ask people to go back and look at those videos again. You notice every one of those Hindutva groups that were chanting and marching throughout the streets in the United Kingdom, they were wearing a mask. So there is an element of, and you know, we can bring in the whole excuse of COVID and all that, but in reality, there was not one single, Hindutva supporter who was chanting and going and marching in the streets of the United Kingdom that wasn't wearing a mask. That means that there is a sense of, you know, whenever you have your identity to be hidden, there's a serious concern there that the actions a human being takes upon that is different. And the Muslim community response was very interesting because they were not wearing masks. They were open about who they are, who their identity is, and their rights to protect what they believe in. And they were not going to allow Islamophobia to be spread by these groups. And that's basically what they're doing. This whole marching, chanting was sort of an intimidation tactic. And I think what's also happened, which is very interesting, and I think this should be observed, is now people are realizing outside of the South Asian region, particularly outside of Pakistan, how threatening this may be. Particularly the Kashmir issue, which has been pending for almost 70 years, over 70 years, is a serious concern. This is all interlinked with this idea, and taking away Kashmir's autonomous status and try to force, you know, settlers into, again, following an Israeli model. So this is not surprising. These are tactics that we're going to see increasing. And I'm really concerned with the current prime minister, who basically has identified that Islamic terrorism, quote unquote, is the most significant threat in the United Kingdom. So, and this is something he said a few months ago. That's something that, you know, I would like to see how it's going to play out, what he means by that. It's a lot of ambiguous words. And I'm really concerned with the United Kingdom right now because there's an economic crisis that's on. At the same time, we have the crisis in Ukraine. So there's a lot of pressure that's on there that gives a rise to this nationalism and hatred. And Islamophobia is going to only increase in these type of environments. And Hindutva is only going to add fuel to it.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Sayyid Muaz Shah for being on the program. He's the director of Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Robert Cart, journalist and researcher, tweeted, "Stop the India genocide. Indian Muslims rally in London to condemn Hindu fascist Modi government and Hindutva terror against India's minorities." Sayyid Haydar Rizvi, social media influencer, said, "Global Islamophobia hate comes from only three places, India, USA, UK, where India has become a major source of anti-Muslim hate crimes. Western culture, which is based on white supremacy and imperialism in the name of modernism, and Hindutva culture, which is based on racism, casteism." Raja Faisal, journalist, posted, "Activists of Khalistan movement in USA protest against rising Islamophobia in India, standing shoulder to shoulder with our Muslim brethren against Hindutva tyranny of India," they say.
And that was our episode about the RSS political ideology sweeping across the West, sowing seeds of hate crimes and religious polarization. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Is a very special city. It's spectacular even from this height. the traditional and modern textures just next to each other. The Persian Gulf is also great, beautiful, proud, unique. Bushehr coasts are very attractive. There are Deylam Port, Delvar Port, and Bushehr Port.
Dear passengers, we are approaching the runway. Please fasten your seatbelts and get prepared for landing. Thank you.
Oh, look at these old wooden fishing launches. Fishing is still common among the locals. I'm going to visit many places in Bushehr, but my main destination is Saadat School. And the plane is landing. Saadat School, also known as Saadat Muzaffari School, is one of Bushehr's attractions located at Imam Street. Saadat School was founded in 1900 during the Qajar period and was one of the most important educational centers of that time. The school was originally founded by the ruler of Bushehr at that time named Ahmad Khan Daryabegi. Saadat School was the first modern school in south of Iran and played an important role in the cultural development of the region. Nowadays, it is also visited as one of the historical and cultural attractions of Bushehr. The school's building, its wooden doors and colorful windows are very interesting. The Qajarid king, Muzaffaruddin Shah, made financial contribution for the establishment of Saadat School, so the school was also known as Saadat Muzaffari School. Today, there is a small museum in the new building next to Saadat School, where documents, textbooks, and student-owned objects are publicly displayed.
Passengers of flight number 357 for Tehran are requested to proceed to gate number 5 for boarding.
I should take a taxi. Taxi! Thank you. This school came to the spotlight at the first days of its establishment. It had prominent graduates in different fields of study, including human sciences, writing, poetry. It had also graduates from foreign countries, including Iraq, Kuwait, India, Zanzibar, Central Asia, and Persian Gulf states. It seems great.
I am now in front of Saadate School. The Islamic Iranian architecture of the school is noticeable just from outside. White walls, wooden doors, mesh windows with colorful glasses. Very special. It's extraordinary. Let me go inside. As you walk inside, you see a very big yard stretching to wide traditional arches. And then there are corridors which reach the classes. It's interesting for me that the light well in all the classes include colorful glass windows. The architecture of Saadate School, just like the central texture of the city of Bushehr, has a startling beauty. It's amazing. This school was repaired in 2014. The repair work lasted for 18 months. It must be a hard job to do. Let me enter one of the classes. Oh, very big and spacious. Good for the students. And look at the old pictures on the wall, dating back to about a century ago. Oh, nowhere is like my beautiful Iran. You have to take a trip to Bushehr and visit this amazing place yourself.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
After the Friday prayers, people of Iran poured into the streets to express their disgust at the heinous act of terror by Daesh Takfiri terrorists and ask for revenge against the group. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has already assured the nation that the perpetrators will face due punishment. President Ebrahim Raisi has also said that the root cause of the crime has been identified and that Iran will deliver a decisive blow to the architects and operatives of this plot. A blow that will make them regret ever committing such act. Daesh had already tried to pull off similar terrorist attacks in the country when they plotted the parliament attack and the bombing of Ayatollah Khomeini's mausoleum that left a dozen Iranians dead. Iran's anti-terror attacks ramped up significantly following the attacks on its soil through Iran's martyred anti-terror icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. While these were the only attacks on Iran claimed by Daesh, there have been several other terrorist attacks by other more globally obscure but equally vicious groups. Among them, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, or the MKO, has the highest body count. 17,000 Iranians have died at the hands of the vile group that even joined forces with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war to carry out cross-border attacks. For years, the group was even on the U.S. list of terrorist groups before it was removed from the list in 2012 to receive funding more easily. Funding such as the massive annual events that the MKO manages to organize without having any backing by the people of Iran, neither inside the country nor outside. These events are often attended by top U.S. officials such as Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, or a number of British members of parliament to at least attempt to give the so-called Free Iran Conventions the legitimacy it sorely lacks. Among other terrorist groups that, while definitely not on the scale of the previously mentioned two, have still tried to deprive Iran of its security, we can name Jandallah terrorist group led by Abdulmalik Righi. Righi's group was responsible for the death of tens of Iranians in the southeast province of Sistan and Baluchistan before he was arrested and executed by Iranian authorities. Separatist groups such as Al-Ahwaziyya and the Kurdish Komala have also been responsible for a few terrorist attacks in the west of Iran, with the latter serving a prominent role in the recent riots across the country. But their plot to capitalize on the riots to further their separatist agendas was quickly foiled by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC carried out two ballistic missile attacks on Komala's bases in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. The IRGC had warned Iraq prior to the attack that Iran will not tolerate the existence of such groups who were, as reported by the IRGC, plotting to attack Western Iran in its neighborhood. According to a joint statement between Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and the intelligence organization of the IRGC, involvement of the U.S. in the recent riots in Iran has been proven. The U.S. and its spy agencies have even branched out their plans in three stages: before, during, and after the unrests. The CIA is referred to in the joint statement as the main culprit for inciting the riots. But the CIA is aided by Israel's Mossad and Saudi Foreign Intelligence Services, with the help of the most vicious of terrorist groups. Inciting despair among the Iranian population with the help of the massive amounts of funding that is given to foreign Farsi-speaking media outlets is listed among the primary tactics used to incite the unrests. Teaching effective escalation tactics during unrests have also been documented as another tactic used by these spy agencies. But among the many other items listed, none of them would be possible without the massive funding that the US, UK, Israel, and their Saudi allies give to the media outlets and individuals who capitalize on people's emotions. Also, supposedly international platforms such as Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter freely violate their own rules in this particular case and allow posts that incite violence to be freely uploaded onto their platforms. An extra $53 million have also been allocated by the CIA to give to these Farsi-speaking media outlets and individuals on top of their annual payments. Israeli influence, however, should not be ignored. Just recently, the IRGC dismantled a network of Mossad-affiliated terrorists in West Azerbaijan province. The investment of these spy agencies in inciting unrest in Iran has been proven time and time again, and cannot possibly fit into a short clip. Rest assured, you will hear about more evidence of foreign meddling in Iran's recent riots in the days and weeks to come.
Tehran has once again rejected baseless accusations about Iranian-made drones being used in the Ukraine war. The Islamic Republic's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, has clearly stated that Tehran would not remain indifferent if it is proven that Iranian drones are being used in the war in Ukraine against people. The top Iranian diplomat had previously stated that Tehran and Moscow have defensive cooperation, saying it's not Iran's policy to provide Russia with weapons and drones to be used in Ukraine. Tehran has time and again clearly stated its opposition to war and any escalation of conflict, urging self-restraint on both sides. Iranian officials say the allegations leveled against the country stem from an ongoing Western campaign to pressure the Islamic Republic. Russian officials have echoed similar remarks.
Everything that is now being done on the Iranian track is subordinated to one goal, pressure on this country. And Washington is mobilizing NATO and EU countries for this in support of its position.
Also, the US, EU, and UK have moved to impose sanctions on Iran over the baseless accusations, supporting the notion that the West only wants to put more pressure on Iran. Meanwhile, Britain, France, and Germany have called on the UN to investigate the allegation. But Iran's ambassador to the UN has described the possible probe as illegal within the framework of Resolution 2231. In a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antony Guterres, Amir Saidi Ravani argued that the UN arms embargo on Iran mentioned in the resolution has expired in 2020, saying this means no Iranian sale or transfer of weapons or related materials to other countries is ever since subject to the resolution. The Iranian diplomat also urged the international body not to act based on the anti-Iran allegations by Western countries. Meanwhile, Russia had described the claims by the Western states as conspiracy theories, warning the UN against conducting a probe into such allegations.
No arms transfers in violation of Resolution 2231 have been ever conducted by Iran, and no drones were supplied by Iran to Russia for the use in the conflict in Ukraine.
Moscow has warned that it would reassess its cooperation with the world body if it carries out an investigation into the origins of the drones. Tehran has dismissed accusations by some Western countries and their media outlets that it provided weapons, including drones, to Russia for deployment against Ukraine. Iran's foreign ministry has called the allegations unfounded and made on the basis of misinformation and ill-intentioned presumptions. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July, with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleging that Washington had received information indicating that the Islamic Republic was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred drones, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline for use in the war in Ukraine. However, the Pentagon said it could not confirm the transfer of any Iranian weaponry to Russia. Since the very beginning, Iran rejected the claims, with the country's foreign ministry stating Tehran's preparedness to hold dialogue with Ukraine towards nullification of the allegations. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has even proposed a joint meeting between Iranian and Ukrainian military personnel and experts to review battlefield evidence of Iranian drones used by Russia in Ukraine. Despite that, Kyiv and its allies repeated the baseless American narrative without providing any evidence. The US, EU, and UK imposed sanctions against the country. So, if Kyiv and the West are so sure, then why are they reluctant to provide detailed evidence that supports their claims? Plus, while Iran has managed to advance its defensive capabilities despite US sanctions, is Washington using Ukraine as a false pretext to bring the Europeans along in a bid to impose an arms embargo against Iran to hamper the country's progress in the defense sector?
Iran has witnessed a deadly terrorist attack. The carnage happened at a holy shrine in the south-central city of Shiraz in Fars province. It left over a dozen people dead, including women and children. Over two dozen people were also injured in the attack. The bloodbath happened at the Shah Cheragh Shrine, which is one of the popular pilgrimage sites in Iran. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. The gunman shot his way into the shrine through one of the entrances. He then headed to the main compound, where he opened fire at pilgrims and staff. Eyewitnesses have told reporters that loud screams were heard in the women's section of the shrine at prayer time, when suddenly an armed man was spotted with a Kalashnikov firing indiscriminately in the compound of the shrine. Officials say the perpetrator is a non-Iranian national who has been arrested. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a statement on the incident, saying that strong action must be taken to identify and tackle the root causes of such heinous crimes. The leader said that all people and entities in the country are responsible in the face of seditious acts by the enemy and their traitorous or ignorant stooges. He advised everyone to stay united against those undermining the people's security and disrespecting their sanctities. Iran says the attack is part of a larger plot to destabilize the country. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian says that Tehran has reliable information that shows that terrorists and foreign meddlers have created a multi-layered scheme to make the country insecure. He says this latest attack has unraveled the sinister intentions of those promoting terror and violence in Iran. Earlier, President Ebrahim Raisi expressed his condolences to the families of the pilgrims who were killed or injured in the attack.
These riots paved the way for terrorist attacks. They came to Shah Cheragh Mausoleum and sprayed with bullets innocent people who were worshipping God. The ground for such terrorist attacks was prepared by riots.
The carnage in Iran has sparked a wave of condemnation. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly censored the attack and called for bringing the perpetrators to justice. Syrian Foreign Ministry has called the mass shooting a cowardly act, while blaming the U.S. for using terror attacks as a tool to coerce nations into submission. Russia and China have also condemned the carnage. And Pakistan's Foreign Office spokesperson and the Speaker of the National Assembly have condemned the attack, saying the people of Pakistan share the grief of the Iranian nation. Sayyid Ammar al-Hakim, the head of Iraq's National Wisdom Coalition, also decried the attack. Iranian officials say the terrorist attack has revealed the actual extent of the enemy's cruelty. It comes against the backdrop of the latest foreign-backed riots, which erupted after a young woman, Mahsa Amini, died in the hospital 3 days after she collapsed in police custody. Iran has denounced the silence of human rights organizations on the terrorist crime in Shiraz. It says the terrorists based in the U.S. and Europe enjoy unwavering backing there, and Western countries refuse to publicly condemn terrorist incidents inside of Iran.
After 20 years of American deployment in Africa, the Pentagon has admitted that the area is getting worse. The Pentagon says the security environment has deteriorated and that violence has expanded in intensity and geographic reach. A report from the Pentagon's Africa Center for Strategic Studies has shown that militant attacks increased by 300% in Africa over the past decade. Violent events linked to militant groups have doubled since 2019. More than 6,200 violent events were attributed to terrorist groups in 2022, a 21% increase from the previous year. Almost 15,000 deaths were linked to the increase in terrorist-related activity. The West Sahel region and Somalia were the militancy hotspots where nearly 95% of the attacks had been carried out since 2019. Extremist groups affiliated with Daesh and Al-Qaeda militants, such as Al-Shabaab, are mainly responsible for the attacks. In this regard, the Pentagon's African Command, or AFRICOM, whose area of responsibility covers all of Africa except Egypt, describes the duties of the force as promoting regional security, stability, and prosperity, while assisting to strengthen the security forces of allied nations. But it also admits AFRICOM will work to advance U.S. national interests on the continent. Both Somalia and the Sahel are actively hosting U.S. troops, and the U.S. now has some 30 military bases scattered across Africa. Former U.S. President Donald Trump had ordered the military to pull out all its troops from Africa. However, the incumbent ordered the U.S. military to maintain a permanent presence in Africa. Last year, U.S. President Joe Biden authorized the deployment of hundreds of American troops to reestablish a persistent U.S. military presence. The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. Also, Washington does not have a good track record, even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Somalia is a perfect example of systematic American military failures across the continent. after 2 decades of deployments, drone strikes and commando raids to fight Al-Shabaab terrorists in the country, the militant group has proven resilient and is still able to carry out attacks in the country as well as neighboring states. History has shown that the U.S. has brought instability and conflict to